Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today. So far in our conversation about the Genesis account, we've stuck mostly with its context within the book of Genesis, perhaps a little more generally in its context in the Old Testament. Now, if that were the only context that this book had, it would be clear enough that Genesis is taken, at least by the Old Testament, to be historical narrative. That is a simple account of what happened over seven consecutive days, concluding with the end of creation in seven consecutive days and God resting on the seventh day. If that were the only argument, the question is, well, there's more context, isn't there? The added context, of course, is the New Testament. Does the New Testament have to say anything, yes or no, as to whether or not that Genesis 1 account of creation is historical narrative or myth or analogy or metaphor or parable or poetry? Did the New Testament writers believe in a six-day creation? That's the bottom line. We're coming to you live this Wednesday afternoon, May the 25th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us for part three of our four-part series on the Genesis creation account, today creation in the New Testament, Dr. Joel Heck, professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, and author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, In the Beginning, God, Creation from God's Perspective. Dr. Heck, welcome back.
Once again, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Does any part of the New Testament, any of its authors, give any credence to an old earth creation or an evolutionary view of man's origins and the world's origins, contrary to a simple and plain reading of Genesis chapter 1?
None whatsoever. In fact, it's quite the opposite. By one count, there are 63 allusions to the first three chapters of Genesis, allusions or quotations in the New Testament. Jesus himself referred to each of the first seven chapters of Genesis. Of the 50 chapters in Genesis, only seven chapters are not mentioned or cited in the New Testament, and there is no suggestion anywhere that they treated any portion of the book of Genesis as legend, saga, metaphor, myth, or anything other than history. In fact, every New Testament author mentions the events of creation, and every book of the New Testament except Philemon, 2 John and 3 John contain quotations from or allusions to the book of Genesis. So there's a powerful corroboration in the New Testament, including from the Apostle Paul, the Apostle Peter, and the words of our Lord Jesus himself, to support a traditional reading of the first chapters of Genesis as straightforward history.
Those who don't want to take the first chapters of Genesis as straightforward history will often say, well, there's no passage in the New Testament that says God created the world in six regular consecutive days. Mm-hmm. How do you respond?
Well, that's true, but I would respond by taking people either to Mark chapter 10 or to Matthew 19. These are parallel passages where Jesus is talking about the subject of marriage and divorce, and the Pharisees come to him and ask about divorce, is this lawful to do? And so in the 10th chapter of Mark, for instance, at the sixth verse, Jesus says to the Pharisees, "But at the beginning of creation, God made the male and female." At the beginning of creation. Now, in an old earth scenario or in an evolutionary scenario, mankind came on the scene hundreds of thousands of years ago. But in both of those scenarios, the universe is 14.6 billion years old, and the Earth itself is 4 to 5 billion years old. And mankind in that scenario comes on very, very late, nowhere near the beginning of creation. And yet Jesus says, at the beginning of creation, God made the male and female. So the creation of male and female, of Adam and Eve, that's recorded for us in Genesis 1 on the sixth day, happened, according to the words of Jesus, at the beginning of creation, not 14 billion years after things got started in the Big Bang.
Well,
So it's not explicit affirmation of 6 24-hour days, but it certainly is the implication that the creation is very recent when Jesus speaks.
And if it were only, say, Jesus speaking in terms of human testimony, we could say Jesus believed in the Genesis account of creation. There's no evidence that he did not believe it or that he wanted us to believe otherwise about the Genesis account. But we're also dealing here with someone who was there. I mean, it's often said no one was there except Jesus was there at the creation.
Absolutely. Read the opening verses of John's Gospel. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In fact, John's prologue starts off the same way the book of Genesis does, and John is probably deliberately echoing the Genesis creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, in John 1:1. And then it's verse 3, where he says, John says, all things were made by him. So Jesus was there at the creation, and he saw how it happened, and he knows how much time has passed. He is one that can speak with authority. And if you say he accommodated himself to the ignorance of the people in the first century A.D., I think you end up, not you, of course, or me, but a person who does that would end up accusing Jesus of deceit and saying he really isn't the Lord of the universe. He accommodated himself so that he wouldn't embarrass somebody who didn't know any better or wouldn't understand the complicated evolutionary theory.
Now, by those who opt for theistic evolution or evolution, they usually dispense with the historical character of Adam and Eve, who are mentioned often in the Bible, especially Adam.
Mm-hmm.
But to the old earth creationists, sometimes they want to have a real historical Adam and Eve who come along, as you said, kind of late in the story, 100,000 years ago maybe, and are the objects of a special creation. Nothing else is specially created except for Adam and Eve. That's the usual theory here. First of all, does the Bible in the New Testament regard Adam and Eve as real historical personages?
Oh, yes. There is no question of that. I don't have book, chapter, and verse. Well, it's Romans, and I'm just paging through Romans right now. It seems to me it's Romans 5, where Paul makes the argument that as in Adam all died, so in Christ all will be made alive. I'm not finding the precise verse, but Romans 5:17 says things like that, and it talks about, in verse 14, death reigning from the time of Adam to Moses, and mentions Adam again later on in that verse. So in particular, the fifth chapter of Romans gives us no clue that Adam is a representative of the human race, or he's every man, or something like that. It writes about Adam in the same breath as he writes about Moses, both historic persons. Nobody doubts the existence of Moses. I don't know why Paul would have put a mythological figure next to a historical figure. So Paul takes Adam as a historical figure. There's no question.
As to the time periods, you mentioned at the very outset of our conversation that there's nothing supporting a billions of years scenario, and that's the only one that anybody really credibly argues for. What are the big passages that you would cite from the New Testament that best support a young earth creation?
Well, the two passages I mentioned a little while ago, the Mark 10:6 and the Matthew 19 verses 4-6, two passages in the book of Romans likewise. First of all, in the first chapter of Romans, verse 20, the Apostle Paul writes, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. So when Paul writes that since the creation, these qualities of God have been clearly seen by men, he is implying that mankind has been around since the creation week. That seems to me to be a pretty strong argument. Who is seeing it, and who is without excuse at the time of the creation of the world if there are no human beings around at that point in time? The other passage in particular is Romans 5, verse 12, and I know this is a somewhat controverted passage, but I'll just go through it nevertheless. St. Paul says, "Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man and death through sin," and then he goes on to talk about how death came to all men because all sinned. That passage teaches that death arrived when Adam and Eve fell into sin. According to an evolutionary perspective, death was around for millions, hundreds of millions of years prior to the first human beings coming on the scene. And in an old Earth perspective, if there was a special creation of Adam and Eve in the relatively recent past, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years ago, I don't know exactly where they stand on when Adam and Eve were created in a special way, and there probably are a variety of views there. But even if it's been 500,000 years ago that this special creation took place in their time scale, that still leaves us with hundreds of millions, if not billions of years prior to the special creation of Adam and Eve, when there was death, certainly in the animal kingdom.
Well, let's take a break right there. When we come back, we'll pick up right there where Dr. Joel Heck left off. We're coming to you live this Wednesday. It's May the 25th. What kind of questions or comments do you have about creation and the New Testament? Give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. Leave questions or comments at the Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. I'm Todd Wilkin. When we come back, more conversation with Dr. Joel Heck on creation and the New Testament.
This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Thrivent Financial has a new charitable grant program called Thrivent Choice. Thrivent Choice allows you to designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio. For more information, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice.
Issues Etc. regular guests Pastor Matt Harrison, Deaconess Pam Nielsen, and Pastor Brian Wolfmiller will be speaking at the Premier Worship Conference of 2011. Sing His Praise, His Love Declare. It's July 27th through the 29th on the campus of Concordia University, Nebraska. For more information on the worship conference, Sing His Praise, His Love Declare, visit seward2011.org or call 402-643-2983.
Independent and in the black for 2 years and running, you're listening to Issues Etc.
One woman's tragedy benefits others.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
In April 1998, Lou Ann Heron, a 33-year-old mother of two, went to the A to Z Women's Center in Phoenix, Arizona, seeking a late-term abortion. Because she was 2 weeks beyond the state limit, the clinic staff performed numerous ultrasounds trying to get a different gestational age. Relying on the fraudulent test, Dr. John Biskind performed the dangerous procedure. 2 hours later, Lou Ann Heron died in the abortion clinic. Dr. Biskind was convicted of manslaughter, and Arizona enacted new health and safety regulations for abortion clinics. Listen next time for more.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Folks, there is still plenty of time to register for a great conference coming up on the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. It's called The Crescent and the Cross, Islam and Christianity. It features Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Paul Meyer. Now, this is June the 11th through the 14th on the campus of Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. For more information on Crescent and the Cross, Islam and Christianity with Dr. Paul Meyer, visit their website, concordiabible.org, concordiabible, all one word, .org, or give them a call, 262-243-4343, 262-243-4343. Mike is listening in Kansas City. Mike, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yeah, thank you, Pastor, and I wish people listening would consider supporting Issues Etc. It's a great resource. And Pastor Heck, I've really enjoyed this series. One of the reasons is because I've got a friend in particular who holds to an old earth view of Christianity. And the best argument I've found had to do with it's very simplistic, but I wonder what you thought about it. It has to do with death either being our friend or our enemy. And in the evolutionary worldview, death is actually your friend. It's the thing that actually helps you to progress throughout the generations. Whereas in a Christian worldview, especially in the New Testament, death is always classified as our enemy. I mean, I just don't see how those two things can be reconciled.
Mike, thanks for listening in Kansas City. Dr. Heck.
I think that's a good point. The last enemy to be destroyed is death, is part of Paul's argument in 1 Corinthians 15. You do end up with some sort of strange contusions of a reading of natural history that the old earth creationists have to describe death as a very positive thing. And then you have somebody like atheist Richard Dawkins, who will write about all of the horrible cruelty in the animal world in particular that existed down through the millennia in order to produce what we have today. And for somebody to believe that God could have caused that he thinks is reprehensible. So you've got, the reality is, in that scenario, in an evolutionary scenario or an old earth scenario, you have all kinds of tragedy in the natural world, in the world of animals, the predators and the prey, and all kinds of killing going on. And to try to picture that as a good thing, I think is really stretching a great deal. And I think his point is well taken. He's on target with that.
I mean, it's not only stretching it. I mean, I agree with you completely there, but it is also theologically nonsensical for there to be a world that is red in tooth and claw and basically survival of the fittest, and then this deathless man is somehow created, falls, and is incorporated into that creation, red in tooth and claw. And we're kind of told by Paul later, well, you know, it all started in Adam. Well, no, it really didn't. You know, if death's there before Adam, death did not enter the world through one man. And it seems that simple.
Yes, well, the response that I get from the old earth creationist is that Paul is really only talking in Romans 5:12 about human death. He's not talking about any other death. But as I read Romans 5:12, and as some colleagues of mine have read it, he's talking about death, period, not just human death. Of course, he's especially applying it to humans because of his theological argument there and his concern for the redemption of the human race, and because, in fact, he's writing to human beings. He's not writing to animals, obviously. But he does make a blanket statement that death came through sin, and so I'm convinced that he's talking about all death, not just human death.
Now, I want to talk about Paul in 2 Corinthians 4. This is a passage that may, because of its kind of high-flown rhetoric, be missed for its creation significance, where Paul writes, "For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' made his light to shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God displayed in the face of Jesus Christ." And I will concede, strictly speaking, he's alluding to the creation account, although it's a very strong allusion. How would you deal with this one?
Yes, well, I think that's another one of the many passages that gives us a clue that the New Testament takes the Genesis account in a straightforward sense. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. He didn't say the specific words, "Let light shine out of darkness, but that's the implication of the phrase, let there be light, and suggests to me that Paul here in 2 Corinthians is taking that creation account to be an actual historical account.
Now, if I can't imagine how an old earth creationist would read this one, because they would have to take that let there be light in some other sense than God speaking on a first day light into existence, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure how they would take it. I mean, I always am hesitant to put words into other people's mouth to figure out how they would take that. I'm probably guilty of doing that from time to time. But it seems to me they would have some difficulty with that. They often do opt for the Big Bang theory along with the Great Age of the Earth, which in the Big Bang is typically the most widely held view of from the evolutionist as to how the universe began. But to have a specific statement on the part of God, they'd probably have to take that metaphorically, as they do some other portions of the first chapter of Genesis, primarily the word day.
I believe in the latter chapters of the book of Hebrews, we don't know the author here, obviously, but there's reference made to creation as well. And the one I'm thinking about is, it is by faith that we believe that God made everything there is out of nothing. What's mm-hmm. there?
Yes, Hebrews 11,
I think it would be verse 3,
so what was seen was made, was not made out of what was visible, so that's talking about a creation ex nihilo. It's not addressing the timetable, but it is addressing the fact that God created, and that he created by the word of his mouth at God's command. There's also a passage just a couple of books later that I didn't mention earlier. You asked me what are the passages that I think are among the most powerful passages in support of a straightforward reading of the book of Genesis and the creation account in particular. And this is from the book of Jude. A 14th verse of Jude calls Enoch the seventh from Adam. Now, if you go to Genesis 5, and of course Adam is the first, so that's taken Adam as a historical figure right there. But if you go to Genesis 5 and count the generations from Adam to Seth to Enosh and so on down to Enoch, Enoch happens to be number 7, believe it or not. And also if you go to 1 Chronicles chapter 1 and just read the opening couple of verses, the 1 Chronicles begins with these first 7 words, Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch. So Enoch is the 7th name in the listing in 1 Chronicles. He is the 7th generation from Adam, counting Adam as the first, according to Genesis 5. And the book of Jude calls Enoch the 7th from Adam, which says the genealogical material in Genesis is to be understood as straightforward history. It also suggests we're not to assume that there are gaps between the generations, so that there could have been hundreds of thousands or millions of years between these different people. We need to take that as history. And of course, if we're taking Enoch as a historical figure, then we also have to take Adam as historical, and that simply confirms the way that we've been reading the book of Genesis throughout this series of discussions.
I mean, if those passages are taken seriously, and we talked about this in a previous installment of our conversation, for the old earth creationist or for the evolutionist or theistic evolutionist, we had posed that question before, where does Genesis go from being myth to being actual history? That pushes that back quite a bit for them if they take those passages seriously, doesn't it? And we're talking 7th generation from Adam.
Yes, that's a short span of time between Adam to Enoch, and Enoch is a historical figure not only there but in other parts of Scripture, and so we're down to the 5th chapter of Genesis. If if the legendary material happens only prior to the fifth chapter, then we've got some of those first 11 chapters that are often called primeval history and are considered to be legendary material. We certainly can count history at least from the fifth chapter, and I would contend we need to count it such from the first chapter as well.
Dr. Joel Heck is our guest. We'll take a break, and when we come back, 10 more minutes with him, talking about creation in the New Testament in the third of our four-part weekly series on Genesis creation account. Dr. Joel Heck is professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, and author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, In the Beginning, God, Creation from God's Perspective. I invite your questions or comments. This break is a good time to call, and we got plenty of time to answer them on the other side of the break. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-I-E. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet, @issuesetc. Or leave your question, your comment at our Facebook fan page. We've left space for you to do that this afternoon. Facebook.com/issuesetc. Facebook.com/issuesetc. Did God really create the world in six 24-hour days? And what difference does it make? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May is In the Beginning, God, Creation from God's Perspective. It's written by regular guest Dr. Joel Heck. You can read an excerpt at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase In the Beginning, God by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, In the Beginning, God.
Hi, this is Kate in Japan, and I'm commenting on the program you had about the Unification Church.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues, Etc. around the world.
The most important point is to say I love your show and thank you for doing what you do. Bye from Japan.
Old theology, new technology, Issues, Etc. worldwide. Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. Issues, Etc. issuesetc.org.
All theology is Christology. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Wouldn't it be great if more of your fellow parishioners listened to Issues, Etc.? Well, here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues, Etc. at your church. Go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. The bulletin blurb is updated weekly. Issuesetc.org. Stay connected. Issuesetc.org.
Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc. by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues, Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. 10 more minutes in our third of our four-part series on the Genesis creation account with Dr. Joel Heck. We're talking about creation and the New Testament. We're working from his book, which is our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, called In the Beginning, God, Creation from God's Perspective. You can find out more about this book. In fact, after you've browsed, before you buy it, our website, issuesetc.org, just head on over to Concordia Publishing House through the link at our website, or give them a call and order this book. It's only $3.99. Ask for In the Beginning, God by Dr. Joel Heck. The toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, In the Beginning, God, Creation from God's Perspective. We've talked about this briefly before, Dr. Heck, and that is the meaning of the word day is often one of the places that the old earth creationist in particular wants to try and shoehorn in longer periods of time. You include, I believe, 17 reasons, why day simply means day in the normal sense. What are the best of those reasons by way of summary?
Well, I would list number one, the two passages in Exodus. I don't have them listed in the order of importance, but the use of the word day in Exodus 20:11 and Exodus 31:17, in both passages, the author says that we are to work 6 days and rest on the seventh day because God worked 6 days and rested on the seventh day. And so our work week is patterned after the initial creative week, and that makes very little sense if God created over the course of many eons. That's one that I would list way up there. Another one would be the phrase evening and morning that appears at the end of each day in the creation account. What period of time is characterized by the phrase evening and morning? I would also point out the fact that the author is very well aware of the fact that the word day can sometimes refer to the daylight part of a day, and he specifically distinguishes that meaning in Genesis 1:4 from the 24-hour day, because he goes on after God separates from the light from the darkness and calls the light day, he goes on to say, there is evening and there is morning, the first day. So those time references inside the first chapter of Genesis are pretty powerful messages, as well as the reference to Exodus 20 and Exodus 31. We also have in Genesis 1:16, the author, God, is using the word day in its normal sense too, and it says God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser night light to govern the night. There is, again, referring to the daylight hours. And so while the word day can mean something other than 24 hours, it typically, when it doesn't mean 24 hours, it means actually less than 24 hours, and certainly not acceptable to conclude that it means eons. So those would be the main ones. I also found it very fascinating that several Old Testament scholars who are liberal and don't really believe the first chapter of Genesis are good exegetes of the passage, and both James Barr and Gerhard von Rott, not exactly staunch conservatives, have both written that the days of creation are unquestionably to be understood as 24-hour days, days in the way in which we understand them even today.
Well, that's interesting. You're saying there that liberal Bible scholars who would reject the history contained in Genesis chapter 1 still say, in terms of, for literary and grammatical reasons, you still have to read it as purporting to report 6 consecutive regular days. Is that what they're saying?
Yes. Yes, and even evangelical Old Testament scholar John Walton from Wheaton College, he doesn't hold to young earth or a six-day creation. He has an interesting theory, calls Genesis 1 a temple inauguration ceremony, which is amazing to me, with really no clue in the text that that's the case. But he also admits these are 7 24-hour days. This has always been the best reading of the Hebrew text. So quoting John Walton in his new book, The Lost World of Genesis 1, where he tries to offer another way of getting around the obvious meaning of the text.
Now, on a different subject here, still related to Genesis chapter 1, you wanted to talk a bit about the combinations of the number 3 in various places.
Yes.
In that first chapter. What's there for us with a few minutes here?
It's amazing. There are, by my count, more than 24 combinations of 3 in Genesis 1. The two traditional places are the first 3 verses, where you have the Holy Spirit hovering, God creating, and the Word being spoken. That's the Trinity present. And also in verse 26, when God says, let us make man in our image, I understand that to be a hint of the Trinity. But as I've read through the first chapter of Genesis, I have found what I think are 3 acts of miraculous creation on each of the 6 days of the creative week. There's no doubt that there are three creative miracles on days 1 and 5. It's likely that there are three miracles on days 3 and 6, and it's certainly possible that there are three acts of God's creative power on days 2 and 4. You have three heavenly bodies created on day 4, the greater light, the lesser light, the stars. The luminaries have three functions, to separate, to give light, and to govern. Three types of plants are created. Three types of creatures are created on day 5, land, sea, and air animals, winged creatures. There are three types of land animals noted on day 6, the living creatures, the beasts, and the creeping things. There are three parallel statements in verse 27 for the creation of mankind. There are three passages that have the Hebrew word bara, to create, in them. And the third time in which that word is used, it's used three times. God has three blessings in this chapter, and days 5, and actually going over into chapter 2, which takes us to day 7, but day 5, day 6, and day 7 each have a blessing, none of the others do. There are three acts of separation, the light from the darkness, the water from the water, and the water from the dry ground. The phrase, let there be, occurs three times in Genesis 1. In three settings, God calls or names day and night, the sky, verse 8, and the land and the sea, verse 10. And I could go on. There are a few more, but I've hit the highlights of the list that I've compiled of things that appear in threes in the first chapter of Genesis. And I would say this simply reiterates what people have always thought, or at least what serious students of the Bible have thought, that the first three verses have the Trinity. Verse 26 has the Trinity, but I think the Trinity is there throughout that entire chapter, and of course we know that is echoed in other places in the Scriptures, with God the Father, Son, and Spirit being present at creation. We just talked about that earlier in this session in John 1, verse 3, that names Jesus as the creator of everything that was made. So I find this more than coincidental. Let me just say that.
Well, tomorrow we're going to be concluding our series with you, Dr. Heck, on the Genesis account of creation. We'll be talking with you about science and creation. With less than a minute, what's in store for us tomorrow?
Well, I'm going to look at some of the scientific evidence. There are more than 100 methods for dating the world, and 90% of them unambiguously show the Earth to be young. I'm going to look at some of the carbon-14 information, some tests that have been done on coal and diamonds. Some of that's mentioned towards the end of my booklet, and many other pieces of data relative to mutations and other kinds of scientific looks at the whole story of creation.
Dr. Joel Heck is professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, and author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, In the Beginning, God, Creation from God's Perspective. I look forward to the conclusion of our conversation with you tomorrow, Dr. Heck. Thanks for being our guest.
It's been a pleasure.
I would suggest this, and I know, I understand, that there are many reasons pressing in upon the mind of the most sincere believer to doubt what is there in the first chapter of Genesis. I understand it. I actually enjoy reading the alternative accounts, those that claim billions of years, understanding what it is that's being proposed there. You don't have to believe it in order to understand the claims. In fact, I think it helps to understand the claims of alternate theories of origins to better understand the Bible's facts with regard to our origins and the origin of all things. So I understand the hesitancy, but I want you to consider one thing, if only one thing, from our conversation today with Dr. Heck, and that is our Lord Himself, Jesus, who does not lie, who is truth, who always speaks the truth, presents creation as foundational not only for things like marriage, but allows to be said of Him and revealed of Him that He was there at the creation as part of the agents of creation in the Holy Trinity. And if He wanted to correct us, on the record for how it happened, I think he would be the one in the best position to do so, but he doesn't. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.